This is Red Eyes Radio coming to you from redeyescreations.com. I hope you're well wherever you are in the world. Welcome, as we have legend Colin Wilson with us today for an hour to talk about his books and his works. He's probably best known for the book The Outsider, but he's done so much more throughout the years. He doesn't have a personal website, although there's a few fan sites out there, some that we'll link up so that you can read more online about him and his work. His most recent book is called Super Consciousness, The Quest for the Peak Experience, and we'll be talking more about this a little bit later in the program. But we have many other areas to discuss as well, magic, the occult, and esoteric, as well as his thoughts on Aleister Crowley, consciousness, psychology, religion, and so much more. So stay with us for an interesting discussion with Colin Wilson. All right, so, I mean, Colin, you've written probably over 100 books now on subjects like the occult, mysticism, human consciousness, psychology, religion, and so much more, both in fiction and nonfiction form, of course. And you've been doing that for about 50 years or so, even more, Colin. And I guess I'd like to ask you more generally about the interest in the kind of subjects that you've been writing about, if you've noticed that more and more people seem to come to these subjects and the kind of work that you do over the years, or is it getting less, would you say?
No, probably more, little by little. But it's a subject that doesn't interest the enormous numbers of people, but little by little, it does seem to be increasing.
Yeah.
Largely because when my first book, The Outsider, came out, which is back in 1956, I found that most of my intellectual contemporaries tended to be left-wing and interested only in politics, whereas my interest in, the human mind, human psychology, and so on, tended to be fairly rare. And then, of course, in the 1960s, I got very interested in the paranormal and began to write about that. I wrote a book called The Occult, which is probably my best book on the paranormal. And that immediately brought me a much larger audience.
So, in other words, people are interested in the subject of the occult. And, I mean, for instance, if we talk about your work on Gurdjieff a little bit, the book you wrote on that is basically called The War Against Sleep, which also, to me, imply the idea that humanity at large is at sleep, and we're trying to wake up. And again, this basic idea that you've been writing for this now about 50 years, have you noticed that humankind is getting more and more awake as we progress, or do you feel that it's the opposite? Are we falling asleep, or are we waking up?
Gurdjieff would have said the opposite.
Yeah, I can imagine. And would you agree with that personally as well?
Well, I guess your problem with human beings is certainly to do with our mechanicalness. It's a part of us that I have always called the robot. We have in the mind a kind of robot servant who does things for us. So you learn something sort of rather difficult and complex, and like, how to type or how to ride a bicycle. And then after a little, the robot takes it over and does it for you automatically. So you no longer have to think about it. But the trouble with this robot is that he not only does all these things for you, like typing and riding a bike and so on, he not only takes these over, but he also takes over all kinds of things we'd rather do ourselves. So that, for example, when you're young, you discover that a certain piece of scenery strikes you as incredibly beautiful, but after a while, you find it's more difficult to obtain this feeling because the robot is feeling instead of you. And, love making even can become robotic. I sometimes say, jokingly, that my making love to my wife has been taken over by my robot. So you have to recognize this mechanical part of us.
Yeah.
Now, it doesn't matter that we have a mechanical part to us. I mean, it's inevitable. But what we can do is kind of make efforts to be awake. And when you make this particular kind of effort to be awake, you quickly discover that there's a knack to it that you can gradually get better at. And this is what has tended to happen to me. You see, I've always felt also that one of the basic problems of human beings is their tendency to pessimism. Mm. They tend to feel, you know, that life is extremely difficult. And it's very seldom that you meet an optimistic person.
Yeah.
In my book, Super Consciousness, the last little book that came out, I talk about a man who made an extremely interesting discovery. One day, he was saying to somebody, "I feel so unhappy." And his friend said to him, "You're not unhappy, Chris. You just think you are."
Yeah.
And he said, "What?" And suddenly it hit him that that was perfectly right. We often think things. And what's more, we cause things to happen to our feelings, our reactions, simply by thinking them.
Mm.
And that this is one of the main problems with human beings. And then this is the reason that poetry and music have this effect of suddenly waking us up. It's the shock effect, what Edmund Wilson called the shock of recognition. And it is rather like the shock of going into cool water on a very hot day.
Mm.
You get this sudden feeling that you could not do voluntarily. You couldn't imagine the shock of going into cool water on a hot day. You actually have to do it.
Mm.
And the same goes with this shock we're talking of, when suddenly you have this feeling that everything is okay. It's very difficult to keep hold of this feeling, but once you've established a basic feeling of optimism, this seems to me to be the most important thing. I've always been convinced, by the way, that this is also the secret of living for a long time.
Yeah.
I've always believed that it should be possible, as Bernard Shaw once said, to live to be, you know, much, much older than normal with human beings. For example, 100 ought to be fairly normal.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, we are getting closer to the point where living to be 100 will in fact be normal. And in order to do this, the first thing we have to do is to make this psychological change from the normal kind of pessimism in which we tend to live into a sudden state of optimism.
That's incredibly difficult to do in these times, at least if one is involved in the world of media and news and with all the things that are going on. It's very difficult to keep optimistic. And I guess also as well that actually in one way ties into another question that I wanted to ask you in terms of, since we're on the topic of talking about how to be your own in a world which tells you otherwise, so to speak, and that has to do with the idea of how you view the use of the occult generally in our world today. I know that there's a number of people out there who are pointing fingers towards occult forces that are prominent in the world, in the news, in politics, in entertainment and media at large as well, to as a kind of a conspiracy, if you will, to keep people just in the state that you're describing of fear and not living long as well at the end. How do you view that, Colin?
Yeah, I'm afraid this is likely to be true. But you see, when you said in our world, surely one of our main problems is, you know, that we're living in a world that gives a lot of justification for pessimism, I don't feel that, you know, this is the point at all. Because whenever this shock of recognition occurs, you get that strange feeling. You know, I've told again and again that story in my work about how Graham Greene, the novelist, played Russian roulette with a revolver he found in a cupboard, and how he usually was a pessimistic sort of schoolboy. When he pointed this gun at his head, spun the chambers, and then pulled the trigger, and then he heard just a click and realized he hadn't blown out his brains. He experienced an overwhelming feeling of sheer happiness and delight, a feeling that's far more powerful than any normal feeling we experience. Now, this is what we're talking about. It's actually a shock, a real shock of recognition. And so, to say that we're living in a world that gives lots of justification for misery, misses the point. Because, in a sense, you could say that if you'd looked back 200 years even, you were living in a world with far more misery in it, far more poverty and starvation, and, you know, children being forced to go to work at the age of 10, and so on. So, in fact, we are living in a world in which everything, in a way, is quite wonderful compared to in those days. All we have to do is simply learn to grasp this.
So, it isn't as bad as we might think it is in one way, but the trick there is to stay in that mindset, I think, as well, and of being positive. And would you say that that is about disconnecting from the world, maybe even connecting with the idea of the outsider overall that you've obviously written about, that we need to live our own lives and not the lives of everybody else or whatever is happening in the world, because ultimately that doesn't concern us, so to speak?
Well, you see, when I was in my teens and I first began to think about the idea of the outsider, about the outsiders I admired particularly, like, say, Van Gogh, or Beethoven or Nijinsky, I had this feeling that I had discovered one of the most important subjects in the whole world, and that if I clung on to this, then, you know, nothing else would matter too much. I had a feeling almost of a kind of religious revelation. And of course, it just so happened that at about this time, I also stumbled upon the Bhagavad Gita, the sort of Hindu scripture, and began doing a great deal of meditation and that kind of thing. Well, I think that once you've got used to this idea of making a certain effort, a certain kind of spiritual effort, you've already made the greatest commitment you could possibly make. You see, when I wrote The Outsider, the last lines of The Outsider was that when a person begins this long path, they begin it as an outsider, but he may end it as a saint. And I've always been preoccupied with this idea. It ought to be possible to be a saint, to become a saint, simply by logic, by understanding the logic of this human existence that we lead. Most people's logic is so vague. Their reaction to problems is so immediate that they simply have to learn to use their rationality far more. So this is the reason that I've always been, in a way, a highly rational sort of person.
We can use, obviously, our brain and our mind to that advantage, that we can go about problem solving, and maybe this is applicable to what we talked about earlier in terms of the state of the world as well, that we have to think, and as you said, Colin, compare to how things were 200 or even 500 years ago, and see that we're in a better position maybe now than we were then.
Not only that, but I think that you can actually, once you approach a problem with a certain kind of drive and optimism, the problem tends to solve itself, almost as if some invisible force is helping us.
You said earlier as well, in terms of the how the robot takes over this, the basically our subconscious mind. And I was, interesting enough, reading in an article yesterday about how thought creates reality as well. And it was talking about this aspect of how, for instance, when people drive or other things like this, we actually end up in a kind of a trance, a hypnotic state where subconscious takes over. And this article actually argued that this was a good thing in this case, because if our conscious mind would have been driving, there would be a lot more accidents on the road because people would panic and things like that. And so in that sense, it seems like in certain instances, this is a good thing, obviously, that we have this ability to kind of hand things over, if you will, to the subconscious
mind. Robots.
Yeah, yeah.
The robot is obviously tremendously useful, but we have to learn how to get things back from the robot. Now, when you're young, this is not all that difficult, because fortunately, most young people have a fairly strong sexual urge. And so, you know, if they're interested in a person of the opposite sex, it tends to be fairly easy to suddenly experience this sense of, my God, isn't the world wonderful? Mm. As you get older, this gets slightly more difficult, I find. I mean, I'm now nearly 79. Mm. I should be 79 in a week's time.
In about a week, yeah. Congratulations, by the way.
Thank you. But what I'm hoping is that, you know, I personally wouldn't have no reason, as far as I can see, why my mind should not continue in the way that it is at the moment. In other words, fairly awake, fairly alive, subject to lots of new ideas. To be honest, the only problem with me at my age is I find your legs get less good and it's more difficult to go on long walks, more painful.
How, if we talk a little bit about this idea, if we go back to the occult again, a big aspect of your work, and I remember watching a documentary about Aleister Crowley. That's a few years ago now, but I rewatched it recently. It's called The Other Loch Ness Monster. You might remember that, obviously, you were in that. And this was about Crowley's time at Boleskin House in Scotland. And you were generally talking about magic and the occult. And this comment stuck with me that you mentioned that basically that the reason why people are attracted to it or the reason why people come back to it is because it actually works. It's a potent force, and it's true in that sense. And I wonder if you maybe can talk a little bit more about that in terms of both the magic and the occult, if you make any differences between those two terms, and also what it is that you, why does it work, if I can put it that way? How come these things do work indeed?
Well, Crowley thought that magic was discovering your true will. In other words, that magic was something to do with what you might call the real you. Again, to go back to this notion of the robot, William Blake, the poet, once said, "Each man is in his spectre's power until the arrival of that hour when his humanity awakes and casts his spectre into the lake." And what he's saying is that once something inside you wakes up, there is an extraordinary force which we human beings are quite capable of exerting and which will suddenly lift us to a new level. Now, this is what Crowley meant by magic. And there are quite a few stories. You probably remember the story of somebody asking Crowley to demonstrate to them the power of magic.
Mm-hmm.
So Crowley began to... They were in London, I think, to walk along the street behind a man who looked like a stockbroker who was carrying a briefcase. Crowley walked behind him and began to imitate his walk exactly and precisely. And then quite suddenly, Crowley broke his stride and collapsed onto the pavement. The man in front of him also collapsed onto the pavement. What Crowley had done was in a way broadcast something, but obviously he'd simply passed on some impulse in exactly the way that your television control passes on a radio impulse and changes the television program.
Mm.
So in other words, there is something quite rational and logical about this idea of magic.
And it's, to me, because this idea of will again, do you think that that is the, we could term it whatever we want, but I choose to put the word universe on it. Is it the universe that is responding to our will and then consequently manifesting that? Or what do you think it is?
Well, let me put it this way. I do believe deeply that there are forces outside human beings. I don't think we're alone in the universe, as science tends to think. You know, this sort of view that we're an empty, godless universe and there's not a lot we can do. The reason that I think these people who preach atheism, for example, are a bad joke is that it seems to me to be completely irrelevant, except that by holding a belief like this, you are, in fact, crippling yourself. It's like deliberately tying your feet together and then wondering why you can't walk.
Right, right.
I do feel that we possess all kinds of powers which we can only discover by a certain kind of focus, a certain kind of concentration. Now, in one of my books, I called this focus Faculty X. And I think that the secret of life lies to a very large extent in Faculty X. As an example of Faculty X, I've often pointed out that Proust discovers it in that book, The Recherche de Temps Perdu, that when Proust tastes the biscuit dipped in tea, he suddenly experiences an exquisite feeling of pure happiness. And then when he tries it again, he tries to think, now what is this? Why do I feel this pure happiness? And then he remembers that as a small boy, his Aunt Leonie used to give him the same kind of biscuit dipped in the same kind of herb tea. And that suddenly, the taste of a biscuit dipped in this same herb tea has brought back the whole feeling of this delight and ecstasy that he experienced as a small boy. Now, you can see that, in a way, it's almost a kind of mechanical thing, one thing evoking another. But it could be done, obviously, far more with far more deliberation. In other words, we could learn to induce Faculty X once we began to get the trick. Now, the trick, I am absolutely convinced, is to do with focused concentration. When, years ago, I was lecturing at a place called Sheepwash overnight, and in the night it began to snow, and it really snowed and snowed for days, so that when I woke up the next morning, it was quite impossible to get away from this farm, because the ground was thick with snow. Well, I was forced to stay around for about 48 hours before I got tired of being stuck there, and I decided I really would make this effort to get home. So I managed to, with the help of other people, to get my car up as far as the gate of this farm, and then I had to drive very, very carefully, because unfortunately the ditch on either side of the car was full of snow, so I couldn't tell exactly where it was. It would have been very easy to go into the ditch. So I was forced to drive with extreme care, realizing that if I did get into the ditch, you know, I'd be stuck there in the middle of the countryside because nobody would be likely to come along and find me. Well, after something like 2 hours of this kind of intense concentration, I got back on the main road, the road from Exeter down south where I live. And as I began to drive along on this road, I suddenly realized I'd caused a curious feeling of power inside my head, and that it now continued In fact, he continued all the way home. But what happened was, if I was driving along and I noticed, let's say, you know, a tree or something that suddenly struck me as quite interesting, I'd find that I wanted to look at it as I drove past it. Everything suddenly had this dimension of extra meaning, as if ordinary perception had gone out of its ordinary two dimensions and gone become three-dimensional. Or even more, as if some extra dimension had been given to ordinary things. Now, clearly, I'd given myself this kind of experience simply by the necessity of concentrating very, very hard.
Right.
And so I felt that in a way I discovered the basic secret, the basic trick. You see, if you think of it, Dostoevsky, for example, has many of these moments in which his heroes talk about the great intensity that they've experienced in certain moments. And one of them, Raskolnikov, says, "If I had to stand on a narrow ledge forever and ever in eternal darkness and eternal tempest, I would still prefer that rather than to die at once." And you can see that, in fact, a narrow ledge, if you realize that, you know, you're likely to die, would in fact produce in you this kind of concentration that was produced in me by this drive back from Sheepwash. So I feel that this is the answer. That what I've done is produce a form of what I call Faculty X. This sudden awareness, as if things have been given an extra dimension, as if reality has been given an extra dimension. Now, what I feel is that once this has happened, not only does this become accessible to you, but there is a sense in which it's accessible all the time, even when you're feeling, you know, very tired, for example. It remains there and can be recovered. I find it extremely interesting now, at the age of 78, I forgotten how old I am. I find it extremely interesting to notice every day of my life how I can induce these moments of intensity, because every day brings a new kind of challenge. And what I believe is that it should be possible for all human beings to deliberately set themselves these challenges and, you know, to continue to continue in a way forever.
It's do you think that this is a state that we could be in all the time, or will, is this a draining state, if I can put it that way, meaning that we have to return? Obviously, we have to sleep still and things like that as normal. That I understand, but is it a state that we as awake human beings can be in all the time? Do you think, or do we need rest from this state?
No, I don't think we would want to be in such a state all the time. You see, it's rather like saying that a rich man has made an extremely hard struggle to get his riches, and now does he have to make the same struggle every day? Well, no. Once he's got the riches, he can stop struggling.
Right, right.
And the same goes for this intensity we're speaking of.
Maybe it's more of attaining a level, or crossing a threshold, if you will, or coming over a threshold. Is that more likely, or is that more what you mean, maybe?
What did you say? I'm sorry, I didn't quite catch.
All right, I can phrase that again. Maybe you mean it's more like crossing a threshold of sorts, meaning that if we attain a certain level, then the chances that we fall back are not so, they're pretty slim, if I put it that way. Maybe that's what you mean.
That's right. That is what I mean.
Yeah.
It is indeed a kind of threshold. And once you're aware of the presence of this threshold, then everything becomes different.
Do you think that that's more true of how reality actually is? Meaning that, do you think that this extra dimension there that you talk about, is that always there and present, or is that something that we project onto reality?
Oh, yes. Robert Graves, the poet and the author of I, Claudius, when I went to Mallorca, it was in about 1970, and I'd been asked to write this book about the occult, and I'd only just started to think about it. And oddly enough, Graves, when I asked his advice about this, I said, "What do you think about the idea of writing about the occult?" Graves said, "Don't." Fortunately, I ignored him. But what I did discover by thinking enough about the occult was that we are thinking about a specific set of faculties. Now, Graves once said to me, poetry is written in the fifth dimension.
Mm-hmm.
And I tried to get him to explain it better, but it was never able to explain it better than that. And since then, I've come to see, no, Graves was right. Poetry is written in the fifth dimension. You do achieve a certain state of mind that gets you beyond the ordinary states of the mind. And this is what we're talking about.
Absolutely. That's very interesting. And if we discuss a little bit generally about the how the world have perceived some of the works that Crowley, Gurdjieff, and Blavatsky, among others, have done, it obviously depends on what side of the camp, so to speak, that you're looking at this at. But in most cases, these have been very vilified in our modern time. If you go around the internet and look at occult information and things, you pretty soon stumble over information which talk about how evil people like Crowley and Gurdjieff and Blavatsky were, and how their wickedness have seeped into the world today, so to speak. And why do you think that these people today are still the source, so to speak, for many people's projection of who is evil and who is out there in terms of the occult? Are people simply afraid of the occult and what some of these people were experimenting in and discovering, or is there something else behind that? What do you think, Colin?
Well, no. I mean, it is true, for example, that Crowley was a pretty bad man.
Yeah.
He's the only person about whom I've written a book that I would not have wanted to know, because he really was rather a nasty man in many ways. He knew a lot about magic, but Gurdjieff, on the other hand, it seems to me, was a white magician. He was also a magician, but he wasn't bad in the same way that Crowley was. So it does seem to me that you must distinguish. There are some people who simply have this bad aspect. Don't forget, I'm also extremely interested in criminology.
Mm.
Many of my books have been about crime and criminology, and this is because I'm very interested in this dark side of human nature and in the evil side, because I feel that, you know, this is the only way that we're going to learn real control over our minds, over our consciousness.
And how do you see that this dark side of human nature is manifested in the world today? Is it solely within all of us, within oneself, or do you see that it has manifested itself on the outside as well? Because when you bring up the fact that you're interested in crime, I come from a conspiratorial point of view myself, and I see that many of the criminals have seemed to have taken hold of the whole planet, if you ask me. Don't know what your take is on that, Colin.
Well, I don't know. I don't come from a conspiratorial point of view. It is true, though, that a number of criminals do seem to have achieved extraordinary power. But I don't feel there's any conspiracy involved in this. To begin with, I've always had a very strong feeling that the forces of good are so powerful that they do tend to even out the problems. So this is the reason that I remain basically very much an optimist.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, when I talk about my ideas in general, people sometimes say, my God, you're optimistic.
Mm.
And it's true, I am. And I'm optimistic simply because when I started off thinking about these problems in my teens, I thought, you know, how does one think one's way through to real insight? And little by little,
mm.
I think I succeeded in doing it. You see, I'm a scientist. I was born with a natural interest in science and mathematics. And all that I've done is to apply my scientific intellect, my logical intellect, to this problem of what human life is all about. H.G. Wells once wrote a book called What Should We Do With Our Lives? Now, if everybody thought every morning of that particular question, and far more people wrote answers to it.
Absolutely, yeah.
Well, I think we'd really begin to change things.
Well, exactly, absolutely, because again, it's all about questioning our behavior and what we're doing, and I ask this question almost every day. I try to as well, the question of what are we working for in that sense? What is the ultimate goal of humanity right now? Is it to build rockets to go into space and to explore, or is it just to because these wheels of society are turning and turning all the time, and everyone is having a job which is in most cases a service to someone else on the planet, and so the question becomes, who is at the top of that hierarchy, so to speak? Who are we all working for? Which one has the most important job? And overall, where do you see things are going? What do you see as the purpose then of humanity, Colin? Is it to explore and expand and be of the scientific mind and try to investigate the universe, or what do you see the point is?
The point is, in a way, to get a real feeling, a sense of the meaning of that question, what should we do with our lives? I think once we've got that sense that there is a way of living that is far more meaningful than the way most of us live at the moment, then already you've begun to change things. You see, as I get older, one of the things I notice, obviously, is that old friends tend to die.
Mm.
And you find yourself thinking, what is necessary to keep on going, to keep on developing? And I've got a feeling that the answer is what I've just said to you.
Mm.
That obsession with the notion, what should we do with our lives?
Yeah. It's very simple in that way then. And maybe that's why we also fail to do it, because as it usually is, it's so plain that we fail to recognize it. We fail to see it because it's so obvious, if you know what I mean.
Yes, I'm absolutely sure of that. You see, I've always all my life wanted to be able to spend all my days working on ideas. It's the only thing that seems to me to be worthwhile.
Yeah.
And, you know, here I am, at nearly 79, still spending every day thinking about ideas.
Yeah.
When I was quite young, what I wanted mainly was to be able to stop working for the rest of society, because I got sick of being forced to work, you know, for 8 or 9 hours a day.
Yeah, yeah.
Simply in order to make a living.
Yeah.
I wanted to be free. Well, when I was 24, I was lucky enough to publish that first book, The Outsider,
mm.
which gave me my freedom. Thereupon, I moved down to Cornwall with my wife, Joy, whom I'd met by then. We proceeded to bring up a family, and that's what we've been doing ever since then. But I've had that freedom, and I've never ceased to be grateful, to be delighted to have that freedom,
mm.
to be able to spend every day thinking and working. That's why I've written so much, of course.
Yes.
Because I spend all my time thinking and working.
Mm-hmm. And you, in that sense, have manifested your will. You put intention out there, and you did it, so to speak. You didn't wait around for approval or anything else, because as far as I understand it, then you did your work regardless if you already had a contract for it to be published, so to speak. You did it first, and then it was published, right?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
So, but very often I've written a lot of books that had not been contracted. I wrote them simply because I realized this was an interesting problem that I had to write about.
Yeah.
So I think there's a particular kind of focused concentration that means that once that you've achieved it, you have this sort of feeling that, you know, of course life has a meaning, and of course once you've seen this meaning, it's not tremendously difficult to keep pursuing the meaning.
Yeah, that's right. And how do you see, if we talk about this, the robot concept again, and I know that you come from a positive outlook, and I do too. I would agree with you, and I would even agree with what you said earlier in the program, that there's forces, if you will, outside of humanity, that we are being aided, and our experience at large is in one form or another kind of being overseen or even guided in some instances. But I also see in some cases that this the robot mentality is very prominent today, and I see that that is slowly taking over, if you will, and something will have to happen for this to break, for people to awake on masse.
It's always the robot is one of the best things that ever happened to human beings. We wouldn't have achieved our present level if it hadn't been for the robot.
Right.
The reason that human beings are the most efficient animals on the surface of the earth is that we have a more efficient robot than any other animal.
Hmm.
So don't knock the robot. The robots are of immense importance. The robot is, in a way, the reason that we've achieved this present level of evolution.
Hmm.
Once we've really begun to understand our interaction with the robot, then it gets interesting. And this, of course, is what Gurdjieff spent all his life doing. He was interested. You see, when he talked about sleep, what he meant was that the robot, the fact that man is mechanical.
Mm. Do you think that that's in a more literal sense, even maybe? If we look at it this from the point of view of if we indeed have a creator out there, it can be argued that we've been put together. We're kind of a biological robot, if you will, in that sense. And we've also been, the purpose might be, for this robot is to also to obviously inhabit a spirit, or within it hold a soul, if you will. Would you agree with that, Colin?
Well, I have a feeling that many things are intended. In other words, there's already a force there pushing us in a particular direction. Our problem is to understand the force, to try to understand it instinctively.
Mm.
Instinctively. We're sort of rather like ships who are driven by winds with sails. And our main problem is, you know, to keep before the wind.
Yeah.
And this I feel very, very strongly. You know, the thing that makes me aware of this is when peculiar synchronicities occur, you know, sometimes absurd synchronicities that seem so absurd, you think, you know, this is hardly real. When they do, it tells you, you know, that really there is a kind of meaning behind things which is normally hidden.
Hmm.
I mean, for example, years ago, I got very interested in a cult called the Cult of Melchizedek.
Yeah.
It was one of the obscure biblical prophets. And I began trying to learn everything I could about the cult of Melchizedek. And I also learned that another friend of mine, Jacques Vallée, who was interested in UFOs,
yes,
also got very interested in this cult of Melchizedek.
Mm.
Well, Jacques said that when he was in Los Angeles, he took a taxi somewhere, and he asked his taxi driver, who was a lady, if he could have a receipt. His taxi driver wrote him a receipt labeled M. Melchizedek.
Okay.
So he thought, my God, incredible. He thought, there must be more Melchizedeks around than I thought. So looked in the Los Angeles phone directory, which, as you know, is sort of about 10 feet high. There was one Melchizedek, his taxi driver.
No.
Now, as Jack had told me this story, I happened to be writing an article on this subject of synchronicity. And I had broken it off in order to go out for a walk with my dog. And I'd tossed a book which was lying around onto my armchair to have a look at it when I got back.
Mm.
This book was called, it had an odd title, You Are Sentenced to Life, by a doctor, I think, called Chesler. But anyway, I got back from my walk, opened the book casually, and the first thing I see is Melchizedek.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, now that really is a preposterous coincidence. I just finished talking about the most absurd synchronicity I know about Melchizedek. I toss this book onto my chair casually, which I haven't looked at in years and years.
Mm.
In fact, to be honest, I'd never looked inside it before, simply because I recognized this as a book that I'd bought in Los Angeles and hadn't so far bothered to read.
Mm.
So, you know, when I thought, my God, this is really coincidence, this is really true synchronicity.
Mm.
And ever since then, I've had a feeling that synchronicity plays an enormously important part in our lives and destinies.
Yes, yes.
And that when you begin to get these synchronicities, then you realize that you're going in the right direction. Keep going.
Do you think that they're more common? I've had this idea that synchronicity actually is happening around us all the time. It's just that we fail to recognize it because we don't remember. We cannot connect the dots. Do you think that that's true, Colin?
Well, sometimes, yes. Sometimes you get all kinds of odd synchronicities. You must notice them, as everyone does. You would look in the radio or on the television to find out what's on. And then, you know, you'd discover these odd synchronicities. Somebody you realize is going to be on the chat you were talking about last night.
Right.
And
right.
So on.
Yeah. It is prominent, and it is happening all the time, and some people have even argued that it's happening more and more, and as you said, Colin, I think that the people who are on their own path, the path of their life, so to speak, are probably more prone to discover these synchronicities as a kind of signposts, if you will, on the path that tells them where they're supposed to go. That's what I think.
And I think that one of these people who made this enormously important discovery is the man I mentioned earlier, who was saying to his friend how unhappy he was, when his friend said, no, you're not unhappy, Sid, you just think you are. And this hit him as a revelation.
Mm.
Now, that guy was called Sid Banks, and he's become actually a quite well-known teacher in California since then.
Mm-hmm.
Not in any way an intellectual, a person, you know, without any real background or education, almost an ordinary working man. But the point was, when his friend said, no, you're not unhappy, Sid, you just think you are, this revelation was enough to alter his whole life. So it's not difficult.
Yeah. That's right. It's all about the approach to life and how we think about life. Colin, I'd like to fire off a question here from one of our listeners that came in through our submission form here, and basically it's the question goes like this: You've written extensively on schizophrenia,
yeah,
and at least a bit on on Freemasonry. And the person who's writing is asking if you have any thoughts on the Freemasons' inordinate interest in schizophrenia. And he brings up an example that there's numerous Masonic clinics in the U.S. and maybe even elsewhere dedicated to its investigation and treatment. So this person wonders if you have any thoughts on that.
No, unfortunately, I can't help your listener, but what he says fascinates me, because I am quite interested in the Freemasons, and also, of course, very interested in the problems of the mind, of schizophrenia particularly.
Yeah.
If you can send me some more sometime, you know, maybe drop me an email about it, I'd be most grateful.
All right, there you go. And what about schizophrenia then, in that sense? What is it that have interested you in regards to that?
Well, no, schizophrenia interests me quite simply because, to a large extent, we're all schizophrenics. schizophrenia does not mean, of course, a split personality like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde. It means simply, basically, a certain separation from reality.
Yeah.
Jeff once said that this was the basic problem of human beings.
Yeah.
That what was real appeared to him as unreal. He said that, in fact, we have a particular organ inside the head, which he called the organ Kundebuffer, whose purpose is to make us see reality as unreality. So, in a way, your question about schizophrenia is absolutely spot on. I mean, Gurdjieff spent his life talking about it.
It's. Do you think that we have been, in some way, our brain, if you will, or mind, have been split up then in that sense, that we're hardwired almost to have two different personalities? We have the obvious one with the left and the right hemisphere of the brain. It's as easy as that, so to speak, but many people argue that humanity at large have been traumatized, and therefore this compartmentalization have occurred, where we have multiple personalities already when we're born, so to speak. Would you agree with that, Colin? Have you heard about that before?
Well, yes, and of course, I've also written about this whole idea.
Yeah.
Of the left and the right brain, and the fact that we appear to have two completely different halves. And of course, anybody who, like myself, is a writer and relies therefore to some extent on inspiration is aware of this, the way that these ideas come suddenly walking into your head from somewhere completely unknown. Mozart said it was always happening to him. Musical ideas would walk into his head already fully created. But I think you don't have to be a Mozart to get this. You simply have to take a direction. And the direction you have to take is the one that you and I have been talking about for the past 3/4 of an hour.
Yeah.
Once you've got it, once you realize that this does exist, this direction, once you realize that the question, what should we do with our lives, is a real question, then suddenly everything begins to change.
It's a really good mantra, as it were, what should we do with our lives? And I think I want to fire off a last question here to you, Colin, for the first hour here. We can round things up. And then we can talk more later on in our second. But basically, it has to do with the creative force and what you think that is, because that has been a question that is interesting to me as well. I'm a musician, among other things, and I've been wondering where does the idea of music and the tunes come from? Are they simply a collection of things that I've heard previously in my life, and now I'm picking parts here and there and putting them together in my own head, and now I think it's mine and original, or am I tapping into the mind of God, if you will, or another force that is working through us, through humanity, to put these ideas out there? What is your belief and thoughts around this, Colin?
Well, I think we've been talking about this to a large extent. That is to say, these the things that suddenly enter your head as new, as something new and strange, are things that they were not only already there, but they're there all the time, which means that if we wanted to, we simply plug into them. We could simply switch onto them by switching a kind of mental switch.
Mm-hmm.
More and more I become convinced of this. I've got here at the side of my bed a book called Mega Brain by a man called Michael Hutchison, who has made the same discovery, that the brain appears to have all kinds of weird capacities, which are not at all difficult to switch on.
That's really interesting. Colin, I want to ask you as well here, as a way to round things up, if you have a personal website. I know that there is some fan-based website out there. For instance, colinwilsonworld.co.uk, that's one site. And there's others out there as well, which have details about your books, your biographies, and so forth. But do you have a personal one out there yet, Colin?
I don't think I do. People ask me now and then to join, I don't know, these websites, but I don't know very much about it.
Yeah.
And, you know, really, if you're like me and you're working all the time, you don't really have much time for messing about on websites. As it is, I get so many queries that come to me via my website that I have to put that by about an hour every day, just be applied to them.
That's right. Too much of work in that sense. Well, in any regard, what we can say, obviously, is that your books are widely available. Amazon.com, obviously, carries probably all of your titles, if not most of them anyway. But is there any other sources out there that you'd like to mention for people?
Well, always when I want to get hold of a book, even one of my own, I look on ABE Books, which, of course, is on the web.
Yeah.
And you can get most things on it. ABE Books. That's one word.
Yeah. All right, excellent. ABEbooks.com. We can definitely link that up as well. And obviously, I want to mention your latest title is called The Super Consciousness. Is that correct?
Super Consciousness.
Yes.
It's a book that I wrote last year.
And how is that going as well, Colin? Are you working on new material all the time? Are you currently working on something new as well, or are you taking it easy right now?
No, I'm working on something all the time. Actually, I spent quite a bit of time in the past 2 years writing a big book about Shakespeare and about the Shakespeare mystery. That is finished, but unfortunately, at the moment, I haven't found a publisher for it.
Mm-hmm.
And also, I've written a big novel about vampires, which also is still waiting for a publisher. This is partly because, of course, with the recession, it's more difficult to find publishers.
Yes. Well, plenty of material out there, obviously, and again, you're continuing your work, which is excellent, and it's vital, and it's so interesting. And again, we've just obviously scraped on the surface here, as it were, on some of your subjects that you talk about, and we're looking forward to talking more with you in our second hour. But for this time, it's time to round things up. So we want to thank you so much, Colin, for your time and for coming on with us.
Okay. Well, it's so good, I didn't have to make it. Well, it's so good, I didn't have to break it. 'Cause I'm 10 years ahead, and you're the echo of the things I say. Yes, I'm 10 years ahead. So hard, I didn't want to guide you right from the start. I only wanted to please you, didn't mean to kill you. But I'm 10 years ahead, and you're the echo of the things I said. Yes, I'm 10 years ahead. Well, it's no good revolving all around me.
say, yes, I'm 10 years
We'll be back with more in just a few days. You can see our full guest schedule in our radio archive. Don't forget to sign up for a membership if you like what we do and want to get full access to redicecreations.com. Stay cool, thank you for listening, and bye for now.